when the afternoon presenter was actually being carried out on a stretcher because he had an attack of pneumonia. And the program controller was flapping around like a wet hen, saying, "Is there anybody here who can use a broadcasting panel?" And I happened to be standing in reception. I said, "Yes, I can." And that's how I started back in the UK. It was as simple as that.
It was a tabula rasa. It was an empty space. We could do what we liked. I mean, within the IBA, as it was then, limits. And we did all kinds of things. I mean, we did a live soap opera, for example, whereby the script was written every morning to fit in with the news. The people we had on board were extraordinary. We had, you know, we had Aspel and Everett, we had Roger Scott, we had Nicky Horn, who used to be Emperor Roscoe's roadie. Did you know that? I mean, Roscoe must have been scraping the barrel. I mean, Nicky's only about 3'6". I mean, for him to be a roadie is beyond contemplation. But anyway, I rescued him from that.
Tonight, on Moment of Terror, the thing that went... It was horrible. Don't fail to hear the thing that at Birmingham, starring Lucretia Wobblenogs.
And we had amazing ladies too: Marsha Hunt, Joan Shenton, Sue Cook, all sorts of people. We had the first woman newsreader ever. Sue Denny, her name was, who was the first woman newsreader on British radio at all, and she did breakfast news as well, not just sort of buried in the thing. So we did a whole lot of Simon Jenkins was our political editor. I mean, we did all kinds of fantastic things, and it was a wonderful time. We could break every rule there had been.
She pauses gracefully to dab a little HP behind each ear and mounts the podium.
Ladies and gentlemen, I always get my rocks off with Capital Radio. Hooray!
I auditioned for Capital, and then went to see Michael Bucht after the audition, and he offered me the rock show. And he said, "This is it's going to be a daily show. It's called Your Mother Wouldn't Like It. We want you to play rock music. Now, just go off and do it. I mean, no format, no restriction, nothing. Just do a rock show." And so we did, and that was my first show. And I remember going to Michael. We'd been on the air for about a month or so, and you have to remember, I was what, 23. I joined on my 23rd birthday. I'd never done a daily show before, and I was working with people like Dave Cash and Dave Simons and, you know, Kenny Everett and all these people, that Tommy Vance. They were my heroes. And I went to Michael and I said, "Michael, you know, I've got a real problem about this. I'm feeling very insecure. You know, you give me this show with all these huge stars." And he said, "Listen, you," he said, "I didn't choose you because you're a good disc jockey, because you're not. I chose you because you're a nice bloke. Now bugger off and be a nice bloke on the air." And then he said, "There are two rules to this radio station. Tell the truth and be real. Now go off and do it." And that was it.
The very first day in the office, I met three of my heroes. I met Alan Freeman, who showed me where the toilet was, and he also showed me how to make international telephone calls from the telephone control room for free. So thanks, Fluff. But also, I went into the toilet, and standing next to me in the toilet was the now Lord Attenborough. And he said, "I won't shake hands, love, but this is where all the big knobs hang out." Which I thought was pretty good for someone who hadn't gone into comedy. And so next to him is Michael Aspel, who was on air at the time, came bursting in for a quick pee while the record was on. And Attenborough introduced me to Aspel. I said I was a new guy. No one knew who the hell I was, but I couldn't pee. Because on the one hand, here's Attenborough. On the other side is Aspel. I'm scared witless. And I'm aware of these two men looking at this young guy thinking, he says he's a disc jockey, but he's standing loitering in the toilet. What the hell are we going to do?
Poor Richard Allinson. David Hamilton, who'd come from the BBC, found it a bit of a culture shock too.
I had worked for the BBC for many years and had known the BBC as an animal that was not in any way
you know, involved with business, not commercialized in any way at all. One of the things that we all complained about was that there was no business-like approach towards programs. Then, of course, we went to commercial radio and discovered that everything is business. You know, nowadays the weather is, I mean, almost everything apart from the news is sponsored. So it was a completely different way of looking at radio. It was radio run by business people. And I think we all got the impression in the very early days when Capital Radio was the first music station in London, and when they started in the very early days giving away petrol, full tanks of petrol to people, and we realized that we were up against business people here who were undoubtedly going to be very successful, and so it has proved to be.
David Hamilton wasn't the only person to have left the BBC and suffer something of a culture shock in moving to the other side. I know I did, as did veteran political correspondent Ed Boyle, and my former on-air partner, Douglas Cameron.
It was thought that there was now the right time to give people some news and information which would be a little fresher, a little more entertaining, a little more populist. And somebody came up with the idea of a news and information station for London, and that's how LBC started. It started, as you know, in October 73, and I came in the spring of 74.
I thought always that there was another way of doing music. I know there is another way of doing news. One of the undervalued strengths of commercial radio has been the alternative voice in news. And I wish people paid more attention to and glorified more the fact that there is a different and alternative news style.
A handful of us worked at the BBC and were hired by this new commercial radio enterprise. And I can remember being booted out of the BBC within hours, literally made to clear my desk and leave the building in order to go and work for this thing. They were so afraid of us. They had no particular need to be, because when I got there, I applied for one particular job and was told, oh, no, that has actually been filled. Would you mind going to Westminster? So I potted on a bus and went down to the pointed clock at Southwest One and stayed there for donkey's years. And odd and peculiar it was, because we were young and hairy and reasonably fresh-faced, and we didn't fit and sit very easily in that austere, as it was then, institution, namely Parliament. We were all given tape recorders. Good heavens, tape recorders? The quill pen had only just been invented as far as Parliament was concerned. And to be seen running around the corridors, you're not actually allowed to run around the corridors in Parliament with a tape recorder, was unheard of. But it was just pure, undisguised joy to be able to wipe the floor with the BBC as it then was, and it's taken them 25 years to catch up. And not only was the new voice of news a breath of fresh air, it was a breeding ground for many of the country's top journalists and broadcasters. Among them, the young John Snow, who in 1975, with the use of one of the first portable telephones, got a world exclusive, reporting live on the end of the Balcombe Street siege.
Four gunmen have come out. The siege here has just ended 1 minute ago. There is still a great deal of activity here, but a flashing blue lighted van has just swept off into the distance with its siren wailing. Briefly, a figure came out onto the balcony, looked over, went back in again. Another came out, looked over, went back in again, and then suddenly we saw the four being led across the street into the van. I'm just getting further information. Just one moment. A gunman with a white handkerchief has literally just come out. Really, it is so dark up that end now. We obviously are going to have to wait for the firm confirmation of the police, but the evidence so far is that we are right at the very end of this siege.
Get out of bed, it's time to rise. Time to start another day. Listen to the music all day long. 258-189.
Commercial radio, the first 25 years on talk radio.
Talk Radio Eyewitness Travel. Due to a crash on the A48 Western Avenue in Cardiff, you'll find jams from the Technical College back to Eastern Avenue. Here's Philip Studd.
Back over the M25, where it looks like they've reopened the Clackett Lane services following the crash and the chemical spillage. They've mopped it up, but it's still stuffed down there. Absolutely solid anti-clockwise back to 8 at Reigate.
At Middlesbrough and Teesside, the A1032 Acton Road is blocked by a smash at the junction of Mandale Road. Part of the track is blocked, hence the delays. Talk Radio Eyewitness Travel.
Hello, you're through to the Sky Digital helpline. Hello? Oh, we've got another television on the line, Bob. Look, stay calm. I'm just going to ask you some questions, okay? Do you want the widest choice of channels available on television? Oh, that's fine, very good. Do you want an easy-to-use on-screen listings guide that helps you choose what you want to watch? You're doing very well. Just one more question. Are you worried you'll be replaced? Well, don't be. All you need is a digibox and a mini dish. I know. It's okay. That's what I'm here for. I'll get the installation team round straight away.
If your TV's not living life to its full potential, phone the Sky Digital helpline on 0870 240 2000. Sky Digital is what your television's been crying out for.
Superlative. An extraordinary tour de force. An unrivaled towering triumph. An awe-inspiring feat of genius.
Starting this Saturday, The Independent are giving away 90,000 books in their biggest ever book offer, with more than 10 different authors from bestsellers to Pulitzer Prize winners. And with 10,000 books on offer every single day, you'll never be short of something to read. See Independent for details.
Gripping. Masterful. A colossus. A compelling masterpiece.
Dear Diary, I'm turning over a new leaf. There are only so many parties one can go to. Fine. Except for a few of the girls, so I'll have round to watch Jerry. Oh, and I'll just have to invite Suki, Kushi, Kiki, Didi and Dabs. Mustering the caterers, we could have canopy, champagne, foie gras.
3 5-year guarantee on all TVs in the Order's mid-season sale.
Okay, digital satellite TV. Which package of channels will suit me best?
The people at Dixon's will tell you they're turning people on to digital TV.
25 years of commercial radio. The definitive history on Talk Radio.
Good morning. My name is Dave Cash, and this is Radio West.
Make it fine, make it good, make it sound like it should. With Radio West.
The new radio stations were really about music too, even though strict rules and regulations limited the amount of needle time.
Make it special with Radio West.
Paul Robinson, now MD at Talk Radio, but in a previous incarnation, a DJ on one of the Northeast's local stations, Radio Tees, explains.
Well, the thing was, when independent local radio started, we had 8 hours of commercial gramophone records to fill 24 hours of broadcasting. So we had to actually play all sorts of dodgy stuff that would never get on the air. I remember going through markets and finding old Ronco and K-Tel albums with all sorts of odd acts like the New Seekers, who you'd play because they didn't count for needle time, but you wouldn't otherwise play them. And then we used to write to the record companies and ask them to send tapes of commercial records. We then play the tapes and claim they were actually sessions. And these are just ways to get around the fact there wasn't enough music to go around, and then you fill the rest of the space with phone-ins, which of course then became the commercial speech format that Talk Radio is today.
I think you've really got to put commercial radio into context. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that we were the only country in the world to have had commercial radio after colour television. And when commercial radio first came on the air, we were restricted in many ways. I mean, what was then the IBA, the Independent Broadcasting Authority, had very, very strong rules as to what we could and couldn't do, particularly in relation to things like competitions. I mean, you couldn't give away money on the air. And I remember that we used to have to submit questions to the authority for our listeners to answer. And the authority then had to adjudicate as to how difficult the questions were in relation to the prize that we were offering. Not only did we have those kind of rules, very draconian, much more draconian than any of the rules of the BBC, but we were also restricted in needle time, in the amount of music that we could play. And I remember we used to try and get around these rules. One of the things that we could do was play soundtrack music, which was not part of the needle time restriction. And I used to, on my things called PSBs, which are the program as broadcast sheets that you have to fill in at the end of every program, and then they have to go to the authority and the various collection agencies. I used to invent films and play things like Bruce Springsteen and Born to Run and say that it came from a film and put it down as soundtrack. And it took him about 3 or 4 years, actually, to catch up with me. And then I got a severe scolding.
I didn't realize you were going to confess all right now, Nicky. Anyway, it was partly because of those needle time restrictions and a disgruntled pop star that got Roger Twiggy Day his exclusive on Manchester's Piccadilly Radio.
I was doing the late night program then. I'd got to lie in for a change. And it was pretty free form, man. I used to play just anything I liked, really. So I played an old Hollies track. And I got a phone call in saying, from, we used to have people who took the calls in those days, how things change. And she said, I've got a Graham Nash on the line who says, why don't you play a Hollies track that he was on? Because I played one of the songs that he didn't sing on. He'd left to go to Crosby, Stills and Nash. And although I knew this from Manchester, I was under the impression he was in America. And I was used to drunks phoning up at that time of night, obviously. So I said, well, yeah, go on, tell him I'm the Archbishop of Canterbury. Thanks very much for calling. Keep enjoying the programme. And she came back and said, he's very insistent and he wants to talk to you. I said, well, OK, I'll call him back. So I called back and it was the Midland Hotel. Well, that's a pretty good starter because, you know, drunks can't afford to stay there. And sure enough, it was Graham Nash. And he actually then came in. I said, well, why don't you come into the studio? He came into the studio and sat down and said, what are you up to? And he said, well, just written a song. We had a grand piano in those days. We used to have live sessions, believe it or not. And guys used to come in and play their version of the latest pop tunes. You hear him walking across to the piano. We know the magic moments of radio, certainly in my career, he actually played for the first time ever a song he'd written on a plane over. And that was just the song Before I Go. So it's always a special song, but that was just a brilliant moment in radio history, as far as I'm concerned. And all the record companies were amazed because he never does interviews. And they said, you've really annoyed Radio 1 because they've been after an interview with him. And you've got it. So the fact that I annoyed Radio 1 was a double bonus.
And the competition between the commercial stations and Radio 1 became more intense with the introduction of the Network Chart Show to rival the BBC's Top 40. David Jensen.
It was to be the first ever fully networked regular program that all the commercial stations would get together on and help promote. And it was, you know, hoped in those days that it would be eventually sponsored, which came to pass because in our first year, De Beers Diamonds were our kind of one, you know, constant advertiser. And then Nescafe sponsored it for 9 years until they decided that they wanted to move on. But it was exciting because nobody really took it seriously in the early days because we were up against head-to-head the BBC Radio's flagship program on Radio 1, you know, the Top 40. And but I thought that maybe you could do a chart show in a slightly different way, and maybe with the collective responsibility of all the marketing and promotion departments and all the commercial radio stations around Britain, we could actually do something that would be significant and maybe surprise a few people.
Every Sunday, 4 till 7, this is the channel for hit music. Get into it.
The R&B was a happy time for me too. Those were the days when we used to have rock shows in the evening and then art shows on Sundays and all those kinds of things. My favorite show that I used to do was the chart show. I really used to like doing chart rundowns. It's kind of fun now because I'm responsible for the Pepsi chart on commercial radio, so that's like sort of going back to basics for me.
The great Roger Scott. I mean, Roger and I used to literally fight. I remember a couple of times when we literally fought in the office downstairs before he went on the air, because we'd both got a white label. You know, it might be the new Springsteen or the new Elvis Costello or something, and it would come up as a test pressing, and I would want to play it on my program and he would want to play it first. We didn't even bother talking to the head of music about it. We would just go ahead and do it. And Roger, I mean, there were a couple of times when Roger actually thumped me. Hey, you little shit, you know, thumped me. I'm going to play it first, you know. I'm bigger than you.
While the jocks were fighting over the music, commercial radio was pioneering a different style of speech output, notably the phone-in. Among those pioneers was one James Whale.
I got offered a contract for 3 months with Metro,
where they put him on the night shift.
And I thought, well, there must be hundreds of thousands of people listening. So let's speak to them as well and make you feel that there is more going on, because unlike radio during the day, where the studios are usually very busy, people popping in with commercials and running around doing this, that and the other, at night it's very quiet. So I said to the boss, I think I'll just open the phone lines. I just heard a couple of tapes from an American talk show host. I think I could do that. And he said, well, I don't really care what you do, because nobody listens after six in the evening, so do whatever you like. So I opened the phone lines. The first night, I think I got a couple of calls. And then the second night, some bloke rang in and said something which I thought was quite outrageous, so I told him to get stuffed. And the phone lines went mad, and I hence got this sort of reputation.
Meanwhile, Anna Rabin had some ideas about a potential radio program.
I put together an idea, which I now think is probably so homemade, I'm glad that the mists of time have closed over its head. But one of those segments was phone-in. And I didn't know anything about phone-in, except that it seemed like a very sensible idea to me. If people wanted to talk about things, then you could at least talk back. I've never had any illusions that I was an expert or anything like that. All I knew was that I could talk. And I went to an interview with Michael Bucht and Aidan Day, who let it be known to me that I wasn't at all the image that they had in mind for Capital Radio, since I worked for Forum, which was a sex magazine, and since my first marriage was going down the tubes, which meant I would be hush my mouth a divorcee. And so I stuck there and held my not inconsiderable temper. I think I lost 7 pounds in sweat. And then I came out into Euston Road, which was where the old Capital Radio was based, looked up at this great big building and thought, well, that's another dream blown. And 5 months after that, after I'd gone to work for Woman magazine, I received a telephone call from a producer called Brenda Parsons, who said, we've had this wonderful idea for a program. And I listened to her idea and I said, it is a good idea, isn't it? It's mine.
This, for the very first time, is Capital Radio.
Committee with John Whitney, who was then the chairman pacing the corridors. The Independent Broadcasting Authority said that they could see that there was a value in such programming, but they would be happier if there was a doctor involved. And so I went to Colin Wilson, who was then working for the Forum Personal Advisor, who qualified as a psychiatrist, as a consultant psychiatrist, and said, how would you like to be on radio? And he said, me? On the radio! And we worked together for the rest of time. That was Anna and the Capital Dog.
And the rest, as they say, is history. But commercial radio wasn't just about music and phone-in and a different style of news. It was about a sense of community and being part of the local area.
Not to be killed, because 50 meters in front of me, about 100 meters from my home, a tree caved in as I was driving along, and had it been just a couple of seconds more, it would have hit the roof of my car, and I don't think I'd have been here talking to you. But I drove in, and when we got to LBC, all the generators had gone. We couldn't broadcast. And finally, we rigged the radio car up, and all the politicians and the great and the mighty who were booked to appear crammed into this little radio car. You know the feeling you get when you sort of hunch yourself in there. The only problem was that the rest of the country didn't have so much of the big storm. And at that point, in addition to presenters... And they said, well, right, where's the 6 o'clock news? So we said, we can't bring it to you. Inevitably, one of the news items, fire. It was the morning I would care to forget, really. But we struggled through.
It's not just the weather that's played havoc with live broadcasts. In the 25-year history of commercial radio, cleaners have had more than a walk-on part.
We were just going to go into a news which came from the studio, and this guy turned on the Hoover. He was deaf as a post, this fella, and couldn't hear anything you said to him anyway, so in the end we had to unplug him.
They had studios with doors with no windows. We had no red lights. And in the middle of the night, when people were actually broadcasting live, the very nice lady from the West Indies originally used to push the door open and say, "I hoover."
They've been the reluctant interviewees, like this one on Moray Firth.
Now then, Len is out with the radio car this morning in Forres.
I'm at Lee and Coyle Hospital, just on the edge of Forres. And I'm sitting beside Jimmy Innes, who is 100 today. Amazing. We've just opened the telegram from the Queen. Jimmy, how do you feel this morning, now that you're 100? How do you feel?
Eh?
How do you feel this morning? You're 100 today. You're looking very well. Are you keeping fine? That's good. You've just opened your telegram from the Queen. Did you think you would get it? You got the military medal in 1916. Do you remember that? Do you remember getting the military medal in 1916?
Well, one such vanishing interview attempted by BRMB's Tony Butler has become part of comedian Jasper Carrot's routine.
End of the game came, the Albion had won 1-0, right? And so they got to do something special. So Tony gets hold of Harry off here, says, "Harry," he said, "do something special. Go and get one of the Albion players. We'll do an interview over the lines." "All right." He went right home. So he toddled away. He came back. He said, "Hello, Toto." "Yes, Harry." He said, "I've got John Osborne, the Albion goalkeeper. He's going to do an interview with me." "All right." He went right. "Stick with him, Harry." He says, "After the break, I'll announce it." So they play the commercial break. After the commercial break, Tony's there. "What a fantastic day this is for West Bromwich Albion. They've smashed Oldham 1-0 and hammered their way into the First Division, like what I predicted. Come in, Harry! Harry!" "Hello, Tone. Tone is pissed off."
There have been wonderful off-air moments, too.
We went out to Buckingham Palace, and we sat these three kids down, and I disappeared behind a sofa with a tape recorder, and I put the microphones in place on this Regency furniture, and the prince was brought in, and the questions started. And the two girls were extremely nervous, and when they asked a question, they'd go... And I'd have to shoot out from behind the sofa and say, "The question that they asked, Your Royal Highness, was..." And then I'd explain it. Now, the guy had no problems whatsoever, but he did come from Lee Park, which is a housing estate outside Portsmouth, which has what is described in the area as being a pronounced Hampshire accent. And so he would bellow out the question, at the prince, and the prince would say, "Oh, I'm awfully sorry, I couldn't quite understand that." And I'd shoot out from behind the sofa and say, he's asking what it was like the first time you dived on the Mary Rose, Your Royal Highness. And at the end of about 45 minutes, I couldn't stand it any longer. I said, "I think we've got enough now, so that's great." And he said, "Oh, marvellous. Let's go in and have a cup of tea." So the doors opened, and in came this trolley with the tea on. And we were sitting down, and the kids by this time had relaxed, and the girls were chatting away, and full of beans. And suddenly the guy from Lee Park went, "Are you back?" in a loud voice. And the Prince of Wales said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear that." And I said, "He's going to be sick, sir."
There we were, in Blackpool, in 1973. They hadn't really thought it through. We were on air, day one, broadcasting live from the conference in Blackpool. We didn't really have a studio. And a colleague and I borrowed a ladder at night and liberated a large potted plant from Granada Television and a couple of angle-poised lamps from the BBC, just to make the place a little more presentable. We didn't have any chairs either. We had a couple of milk crates. And Margaret Thatcher, who was then most famous as Milk Snatcher, the lady who, as education secretary, sort of cut free milk to school kids, came in for an interview. And I had to say, "Look, I'm sorry, we've only got a milk crate to sit on," which was deeply inappropriate. And Margaret said, "I said, don't suppose you've got a drink, have you?" And I said, "Yes, what would you like?" She said, "A gin and tonic." And so from a borrowed BBC plastic cup, I poured her a large gin. We'd forgotten the tonic. And she sat on a milk crate in that studio on those first peculiar days of commercial radio. And of course, those competition cock-ups.
I think the most embarrassing thing I've ever done was to give away a two-week holiday in Barbados to the loser.
It was one of those things. Capital Breakfast, 8:10. Good morning. Two envelopes. The runner-up opens envelope one, and they get, oh, you got a two-week Caribbean holiday in Barbados with £500 cash. Fantastic. And the winner, you've won a Mondeo for a weekend. Where's the bloody producer gone?
Children Radio.
We did a thing called the World's Worst Record Show. What used to happen is that he'd go up in the lift with a... It was quite high-tech. He'd go up in the lift with a radio mic to the record library while I talked to the punter who would ring in and say, I have the world's worst record. This is terrible. I'd talk to Chris and say, have we got that, Chris? And he'd say, oh, unfortunately, we have, mate. You know, put it on here, bang it on, play it. And one guy rang up and said, Martin, I have got the worst record you have ever heard. And I said, really? He said, yeah, this is terrible. And he gave us the name of it, the artist, and the, you know, and the number. And I thought, oh, nice and precise. Chris said, oh, I'll see you walk and find it then. So he goes up in the lift, and he said, oh, I found it. I said, okay, let's give it a listen. He puts it on, and it's a dirge. It's terrible. It's awful. Absolutely terrible. And I say to this guy, this is the shit record of all time. He said, yeah, it is, isn't it? I said, yeah. I said, where on earth did you get that? And he said, oh, you sent it to me as a prize.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 5th of October, 1982. Good morning. My name is Owen Oyston, the chairman of Red Rose Radio, Lancashire's first independent local radio station.
Red Rose Radio, good morning.
Commercial radio, the first 25 years on talk radio.
Talk radio eyewitness travel now. M25 anti-clockwise traffic well and truly strung up from junction 6 all the way back to and beyond junction 8. Clockwise also suffering. It's all due to earlier incidents of Clackett services which have been rectified. M6 and M5 is closed a mile from the Foss roundabout. It's all due to some kind of serious accident there. Talk radio, eyewitness travel.
That's it, Mark. I've put my car in exchange of Mart.
Yeah? How much for?
£8.
£8?
Yeah.
Well, I know it was no sprig chicken, but...
No. That's what the ad costs. I want £1,200 for the car.
Now, that is very reasonable, isn't it?
Well, I thought so. Good condition, low mileage.
No, £8's very reasonable.
Yeah, £8 if your car's under £2,000 and only a fiver if it's less than £1,000. And they go on the web.
In exchange of Mart.
Anything goes.
Call 01202
207
702.
Offer ends this month. Deadline Fridays.
The callers you're about to hear are actors. The people answering the call. More information. First Direct is a division of Midland Bank, a member of HSBC Group. Account opening and credit subject to status. Calls may be monitored and or recorded. It says here.
Call Action 2000 on 0845-601.
25 years of commercial radio. The definitive history on talk radio.
This is Mercia Sound on 220 meters medium wave, 1359 kilohertz, and 95.9 VHF in stereo. For the very first time, good morning from Mercia Sound.
By the end of 1982, there were 47 independent local radio stations broadcasting or preparing to broadcast to an audience of millions. What had started barely a decade earlier as a cottage industry was now developing into a federation of local stations, although it hadn't yet won the listening battle with the BBC. It was the Independent Broadcasting Authority's use it or lose it dictum that led to the splitting of AM and FM frequencies. For Tony Blackburn, who launched Capital Gold, there was a sense of deja vu.
The very first record I played wasn't, in fact, Flowers in the Rain, which I opened up Radio 1 with, but it was, in fact, Reach Out, I'll Be There by the Four Tops. It was, I suppose it was a reflection. For me, it was quite interesting because we were playing music from the 60s and the 70s in those days. And I, of course, was doing the breakfast show. I went back on the breakfast show, 6 until 9 o'clock it was then. And, of course, I was on Radio Caroline in 1964. And I remember one of the records I played there was, I think it was Big Girls Don't Cry by the Four Seasons. And I thought, now, here I am again. Years and years on, playing exactly the same music at exactly the same time in the morning, the only difference being on land. I thought, there's progress for you.
But it wasn't all sunshine and roses for everyone.
Rinky dinky dooty, that's Paul Young. Come back and stay. Thank you, Leicestershire. It's been fun. This is Centre Radio 238 AM and in stereo 97.1 VHF and FM.
It's 1 o'clock. This is Tony Cook at the Centre Radio News Desk. Only one item in today's 1 o'clock news. A press statement has been issued in the last few minutes by the Board of Directors of Leicester and Leicestershire Local Radio PLC, trading as Centre Radio. And it reads as follows. The Board of Directors were acquainted last evening with the fact that the IBA had ruled against an offer being made by Crestnote, a company formed by Mr. Geoffrey Poynton together with a consortium for the shares of Leicester and Leicestershire Radio PLC. Under the circumstances, the board have no alternative but to cease trading.
Dear Radio Victory, I am very, very sorry you are closing down so soon. It is a shame. The IBA are horrible. I always tune into Radio Victory in the mornings and evenings. Love from Sean Thomas.
Bless you, Sean. The time is 11:59. Radio Victory has approximately 1.5 minutes left to live. Serving southern Hampshire, West Sussex and the Isle of Wight for 10 years, 257 days. This has been Radio Victory.
By 1990, there were big changes afoot. The Broadcasting Act of that year bade farewell to the IBA and ushered in the Radio Authority. Franchises became licenses, and there was even talk of the first national commercial station, as long as it wasn't a pop station. John Drummond, then controller of Radio 3, said there was no real market for a classical music station other than his own. Michael Bucht had had other ideas several years previously.
1975, I was asked by the AN-AN committee to write a report on the future of local and commercial radio. And I put at the top of the list an FM popular classical music station, 1975. I'm actually on record in a governmental department. So I've been chasing that for 22 years. And it was a wonderful opportunity to do it, but nobody believed at the time it was going to work. It did, thank God. Yes, it worked because it was what fundamentally good radio is, listener radio, not broadcaster radio. Right? I say to people, good radio starts with the audience. It doesn't start with what you want to do.
By 1992, independent local radio was an audience success, but it was the launch of the national stations, Classic, Virgin and Talk Radio, and the inauguration of the Radio Advertising Bureau that brought the national advertisers in. So, in September 1992, Classic FM went on the air and has been a runaway success ever since, once again proving that commercial radio can often force the BBC to look to its laurels. There from day one, Henry Kelly.
I get the same buzz every day of the week that I got on the 7th of September 1992. That's imprinted on our memory because it was day one. And we were just so nervous, I cannot tell you. Because this was a huge venture with everybody out there, horse, foot and artillery, ready to go for us. And then one of the newspapers the next day said, the best thing that can be said about Classic FM is that very quickly we will come to believe, I'm summarizing now, that it has been there forever. It's been there all the time. I mean, the corny phrase, which, as you know, we say that to a certain extent we're a rock and roll station playing classical music.
Michael went to a program, Classic FM, and he rang me just after they went on the air and offered me a job. And I said, but Michael, I don't know anything about classical music. He said, oh, don't worry about that, love. He said, no one here does. I don't know if I should have said that. And I said, look, I'd love to, Michael, because I'd love to work for you again, but I really can't. And about a year later, he rang again. And he said, look, I'd like you to present this program, which is to teach young people about classical music. It's called Masterclass. We went on the air and we did this, and my girlfriend, who is a professional musician, would come into the studio. I'd be playing this piece that I'd never heard before in my life, and she'd say something like, tricky bit for the bassoon there. So when the piece ended, I would sort of open the mic and go, tricky bit for the bassoon there.
Classic Fret.
And today's best music.
Better, stronger, faster. 12:15 a.m. at
Virgin.
Less than a year later came Virgin, now in the hands of a new breed of media magnate, Chris Evans.
I think Virgin Radio is probably the jewel in the crown of all of it. It has to be, maybe along with Classic and, you know, yourselves. You know, we represent a triumvirate of national commercial stations, both all rather representing different things. And I think it's really important. I think it's a bit unfortunate that we're deprived of being able to reach bigger audiences because of the quality of our signals and the type of signals we have. And I think it's the last bastion of monopolisation.
And then there was Talk Radio, the last national station on air.
10:53, 10:89 a.m. Talk Radio.
But its founders failed to listen to the listeners and launched with shock jocks, which were swept away a year later by a new management. Managing Director Paul Robinson.
I think the original founders of Talk Radio thought an American style of speech radio would work in the UK, and it actually didn't. And the reason is we're different in the UK and we want different sorts of radio. Fortunately, we realised that pretty quickly and changed the style of Talk Radio so it became an informed, intelligent, interactive debate led by presenters like Lorraine Kelly, Danny Baker, Anna Raven, James Whale. And suddenly the audience figures and the revenue followed, and now Talk Radio is a big success.
So here we are, 25 years on, with more than 200 stations, small scale, regional and national, 34 million listeners, more than all the BBC stations added together, big name sponsorship and a considerable and growing slice of advertising revenue. Stations have bought out their neighbours, millions of pounds have changed hands, and the commercial radio industry is booming. Yvonne Scullion is head of radio at Zenith Media.
I think a lot of advertisers realise that radio is a very, very powerful medium to reach consumers.
I suppose I am a commercial radio animal. I love it, absolutely love it. I've never lost my enthusiasm for being in a radio studio and the excitement.
And we have opened the cupboard of elitism and given the music that was there over the centuries to people who thought they didn't like it and suddenly discovered they do.
But in other ways, I think it will be wholly recognisable. After all, what you hear from the radio now is much the same as what you heard 25 years ago in terms of that close, intimate relationship which the listener has with words and music, and that's not going to go away.
It's been a success that's been built out of hard work.
I love commercial radio. I think commercial radio has been marvellous for this country, developing radio and giving people much more choice.
But for me, radio is the fastest, the most immediate and the most live of all the media.
I love radio. I've always believed in voices.
If there are no personalities in radio, there will be no radio.
And when you look at it now and see it as this hugely thriving business, you can't help but have a lot of pride in what's been achieved.
Radio is a great survivor. Radio has survived the gramophone record. It has survived the growth of films, of video. It's survived television. It will be in some ways unrecognizable in 25 years' time.
I always believed that commercial radio really could make it, and I think we're getting close to it now.
And considering it was a late starter, it has been tremendously successful, and you know, I'd like to wish it another 25 years, and will it please keep me for another 25 years? Because I still need the money.
When I won the Sony this year and was so gravely criticised for what I said, I'm very serious about what I said. I said, ladies and gentlemen, we have heard a paean of praise to the BBC this evening. And while I love, honour and respect the BBC, I would like to point out to you that this award has been made to independent radio and to me for 24 years' work, which the BBC would not have allowed me to do in the way that I have done it.
So, a quarter of a century on, commercial radio has a great deal to be proud of. And with the advent of digital radio, a great deal to look forward to.
For the next 25 years, all we want to do is polish what we have and look after it. And the next 25 minutes I'm struggling with at the moment.
It was weird, it was wonderful, it was eclectic, it was mad, and it was exhausting. But, hey, it was memorable.
Was a Talk Radio production for the Independent Local Radio Network, produced by Joe Phillips and Peter G.
53 and 1089 AM Talk Radio.